Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
Now, delighted to say that Michael Leiner happens to be in Dublin and he's made some time for us. Michael, you're very welcome to Dublin. Hello.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Joe.
I presume, and it's a very cliched point to start on, so we won't dwell on it overly, but I presume for a certain generation you are undetachable from the corner in Lansdowne Road in 1991.
Yes, yeah, that's, one would say arch enemy number one, but Dublin holds some great memories for me and particularly back in 91, which is a long time ago, but I get reminded every time I come here.
Yeah, no doubt. The quietest stadium that you probably ever scored a try in when you went over the line.
It was, actually. I thought there was something wrong, then I realised it was the Irish that were upset with me. But there's a lovely story about that. About a few years ago, I came over here in Dublin for a dinner. And my wife and three boys were coming over the next day. And I was sitting next to the dinner with Ollie Campbell. And I was telling him, my wife's coming over, and the boys, he said, oh, come and pick them up. Typical sort of wonderful, very hospitable Ollie sort of way.
Yeah.
And so he met me at the hotel at 8 in the morning and off we went and picked them up. And coming back into Dublin, you drive at a certain stage then and the Aviva Stadium appears. And Ollie said to my boy, see, there's the rugby stadium. They were, oh, wow. He said, that stadium used to be called Lansdowne Road and your dad scored a famous try there. And they had to demolish the stadium and build that because of your dad. And my younger son said, oh, Dad, you're so mean. Why did you do that to the Irish people and make them build a new stadium?
But anyway, we agree with your son entirely.
Yeah,
that was an extraordinary generation of Australian players that you were part of.
Mm.
So you emerge in the scene as this, I presume, wide-eyed 18, 19-year-old for the Grand Slam in 84. And then a few years later, you win the 91 World Cup. And, wow, that's a pretty extraordinary career already.
Yes, it was a pretty golden era for Australian rugby, and it was a sort of a, I guess the forerunner of that was paved by players before us who did the hard yards against New Zealand, some coaches that came over here and learnt a lot from rugby over in these parts as well, and gradually Australian rugby was blessed with a few players that came in the early 80s, Mark Eller, Paul McLean, Mark Lone, Tony Shaw, these sort of players, and came together in 84 where we had a great squad under Alan Jones, the coach then, and we had a great tour, and it was just a really happy squad.
Right.
I mean, we worked very hard, but it was a really happy squad. We played good rugby and ended up winning the Grand Slam when nobody really gave us that sort of chance to do that, where the 81 tour before that was the much heralded one, but they didn't quite make it. And then, I guess, coming out of that, there was three young players, me being one of them, but Campese and Nick Farr-Jones as well. And we then were joined in 91 by the likes of Phil Kearns, Simon Poitevin, and Jason Little, Timmy Horan. You know, so we had a great squad in 91 as well. And once again, it was just a really happy team and we did well.
That's very interesting you say that coaches came to this side of the world and picked up a few bits and brought it back.
Mm.
I didn't realise that was how it had happened in Australia.
Yeah, well, it goes back a little bit further to the early 70s. A fellow called, by the name of Bob Templeton, who was from Queensland and a great and very well-respected man and rugby coach. And he came and over here and a guy called Dick Marks as well, who was a coaching sort of director in Australia. He came over and learnt from people like Carwin James and the like and spent a bit of time over here with him and others. And also they saw New Zealand as the university of rugby. And so we started playing against New Zealand provinces. The coaches started looking at how New Zealand did things, nearest neighbour, I guess.
Sure.
And, you know, while we took quite a few beatings at the hands of the Canterbury and Auckland and these Wellington and these sort of teams, it started to infiltrate the way that Australian rugby played and was taught. We had some great players, you know, that during those 70s, Andrew Slack, Mark Lone, I've mentioned a few of them, Paul McLean, these sort of guys who were very much part of that, were coached by Bob Templeton as well. And that sort of paved the way for the resurgence and, well, not the resurgence, but the Australian rugby sort of being born onto the world stage in the 80s, I guess.
And when you think of Australian rugby identity, I mean, it's skill. And it's a bit of risk, and it's excitement, and it's off the cuff, and it's lovely. I mean, which must have been a joy to play as well.
Yeah, it was. And It was just the way, I guess, we're brought up. Rugby league was a big presence and still is a big presence in Australia. So it's not about sort of having to entertain the crowd. It was about trying to find a way of the best way of winning a rugby game.
So it was still pragmatic at heart.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there was times when we had to kick the ball. I often got criticised by David Tampese and others for kicking it too much. But, you know, there's times and you kick well, or you can kick poorly. And sometimes when you kick properly, it does put the opposition in two minds, put them in doubt, and also there's some attacking kicks. So there's a whole different way, range in rugby games of how to win a game. Mm. And often, sometimes, forward plays part of that. And I always say that really good teams have different ways of winning rugby matches. And in 91 and in 84... We were capable of doing that. I remember playing here in Dublin against New Zealand. We scored 3 tries in the first half, I think, and were in front, and then spent the second half defending. So we could attack, we could defend, we had forwards that could compete with others, we had great backs, you know. So different ways of winning games.
I mean, you're of that generation as well, obviously, which was amateur. Mm. So about 1981 territory through to 95 was maybe the guts of your career. And so in all that time, clearly, you're an amateur. What was your relationship with rugby? Was your career, like your real career in the 9-to-5 world, was that merely a box-ticking exercise and not very much in the back seat, and it was an obsession with rugby? Or did you try and marry the two? Or how did you approach things?
I think I tried to marry the two.
Okay.
I mean, I loved rugby. I also loved cricket. I wanted to be a cricketer. Rugby was my second choice, but I didn't get the chance to play cricket at that sort of level. But I went to university and played rugby for Australia while I was there, so my studies took a lot longer than what they should have. Well, that was my excuse anyway.
Yeah.
But then I started working at a property investment company, and it was basically I'd go to work at about 8 o'clock in the morning. I'd leave at 5 to get to training by 6, train until 9 o'clock and wake up and do it again the next day. And then you'd go and play for Queensland or Australia or my club on the weekends and be back in the office on Monday if we were playing at home, and often with a black eye or a hangover, you know. So,
do you ever look back and think, how did I do that?
Yeah, well, I tell that to people now, and my kids, even my kids, they go, what, you worked?
Yeah.
I said, and how did that? But I always had an interest in doing something else. I felt that even back at school, I found when I was playing sport, whether it be cricket or rugby, my studies always were much better, and I was much better organised because I didn't have a lot of time. So if you had an hour, you had to do it. Mm. Whereas if you're not doing anything, you know, I'll do my study tomorrow, you know. And so that was just the way I was. And so when I started working, I have this interest outside rugby that actually I felt kept me quite fresh. I thought about other things other than, you know, what move to call in a game. So,
or what someone's written about you in the paper and all that stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah, no doubt.
But I also understood that rugby back then, particularly back then, was a good way of trying to meet people. I often felt back in Brisbane that, you know, the door got open pretty quickly if you're a Queensland or Australian rugby player, but the door closed pretty quickly if you didn't have much to say or couldn't do what you were doing. But so I sort of used that advantage of being a rugby player to get further into the business world.
Yes.
I would have liked to have thought I would have got there anyway, but it probably would have been a bit slower.
Yeah. Mm. I guess life bumped along very nicely until, out of nowhere in Brisbane, I remember that seeing the news. You know, Michael Owen, a stroke, and very serious, and wow, and he seemed like such a healthy guy, and people don't know much about strokes. I don't really, unless you, I'd say, encountered first time. I just checked there. I think about 10,000 people in Ireland had strokes in the last year or so, which is actually down quite a bit. They're improving things. But for you, I think it's 2012.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Like completely out of the blue, this was just a terrible shock, I'm sure, for everyone around you. Not just you. A random kind of day. Slightly stressful day, it should be said, but just a random day.
Oh, yes, it was... I mean, I was healthy. I was pretty fit and young and that sort of thing. And it was just a whole combination of things, of which stress was one. I'd missed a flight flying to Australia from London, and had to wait 12 hours at Dubai Airport, then get into Singapore and do a dinner, and 2 o'clock in the morning, find my flights have all been cancelled, and I'm going on to Australia. Anyway, so then it was a whole series of events, and it actually...
Straight onto a golf course then, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it was well, both in Singapore. Then I flew to Australia the next day, and I was playing. I went straight onto a golf course there. I mean, no hardship. I mean, it was great.
Sure. Yeah.
But what I did...
But your body's probably saying, this isn't much fun.
Yeah, and also... Might have slept funny on the plane. I'm dehydrated, tired, you know, all those sort of things. And then I guess the straw that broke the camel's back was at dinner that night in Brisbane. Six thirty, I met with about six or seven friends from school.
Yeah.
Monday evening, just having... I had two light beers. I was on my second light beer. We'd had a steak and somebody was telling a joke and I took a sip of beer and... And as the punchline came out, I started to laugh, and it went down the wrong way, like all of us have done.
Yeah.
But this was quite violent, you know. But you know, just coughing and spluttering, and then I sort of
everybody's pretty laughing at you.
Yeah. You know, you're all right. You know, yeah. Hitting me on the back and stuff, and then I couldn't see, and I just thought it was a lack of oxygen. So, trying to get myself right, and then this huge. I mean, then it was like almost simultaneously a huge pain in the back right of my head, and I remember quite clearly one of the, you know, you're sitting with old rugby mates from school or something, you know, you're all right? And I said, I don't know.
Right.
Give me a moment. And then they said, you know, sometimes somebody would say, oh, toughen up, have another beer and I'll drop you home. But the guy beside me said, you know, can we call you an ambulance?
Was he a doctor?
He was a physio. There was a doctor at the table. He'd just left about 15 minutes beforehand. He'd left, but this guy Tony was a physio and ex-prop at school in the first. And he said, "Do you want me to call an ambulance?" Mm. And I said, "Yes," because I didn't know what was going on. And they arrived very quickly. And anyway, the first I was in intensive care.
And are you so? Because again, my ignorance here is quite. Don't underestimate.
No,
it.
No. Okay.
Are you unconscious then on the way to
no,
hospital?
No, I was okay. I knew what was going. Well, okay, I wasn't okay, but I knew what was going on. I couldn't see and had this.
What's that? I mean, that's a terrifying
thing.
Yeah,
it is. Yeah, because you lose your sight like that, yeah. And but it was that the pain in my head was quite substantial.
Right.
And I didn't know what was going on.
Did stroke cross your mind? Do you remember?
No, it didn't. I just. So the ambulance arrived, they take me to the hospital and into intensive care, and you know, had x-rays or you know, scans and all that sort of thing. And that's when the doctor first mentioned the word stroke. Mm. And I'm a bit like you, I don't know much about them at this stage, but what I do know, it's for unhealthy smokers who are overweight and old. Not the case.
Yeah.
Not the case at all, I've since learned. But then the shock was, you know, well... I thought they were going to give me a tablet and send me home, but no, we're going to operate. And this is pretty serious.
Right.
But basically, there was a huge amount of swelling in the back of my head, and it was causing all sorts of issues and potentially very close to being fatal.
I think if it had grown more,
yeah, and it was. So
you were in big trouble.
Yeah. It was pressing against the spinal column and all that sort of thing. So,
and sorry, there was. I'd say it's quite an emotional thing to talk about, so like, feel free not to get any depth. But was there an incident in where there was an X-ray up in the wall? And
oh yeah, so my father and mother, the ambulance went past their house.
They're in Brisbane as well.
Yeah, obviously. They live in central Brisbane. We're in central Brisbane, and Tony, my friend, who he actually got my phone out of my pocket, and so I was sort of almost I knew the passcode to my phone, and he looked up Mum and Dad, Ian and Mariana, and rang them.
Mm.
And they heard the ambulance go past as he was calling them from the ambulance. And so they met us in hospital. And my dad's a clinical psychologist, so he's dealt with a lot of, you know, brain injuries, etc. before. And apparently they were sitting just out the front in the doctor's booth, which is a glass case sort of room, in the intensive care, waiting for me to. To the doctors to come in, and there was a picture of a scan up on the X-ray sort of light box, and Dad was just looking at that. And he goes, "Oh God, that's that guy's in trouble because there's a huge, big, about the size of my hand, swelling in the back of the head of the picture. And he said, oh, he's in trouble. And the doctor came out and said, that's your son. And so that was quite a... I obviously wasn't there. Dad told me this later. And, it was quite a big
horrific
moment for all of us.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But it was good to have them there, and they were very good, obviously. And thank God it happened in Brisbane. I mean, it could have happened on a flight or anywhere.
Yeah, or next to people who did say, do you know what, lie down and you'll be fine. We'll see you in the morning kind of thing. And is it days, is it weeks, is it months before you're given the, well, you're going to still be around kind
well, there
of
verdict? So the next thing that we're operating, brain surgery.
Yeah.
This is serious, right? And so prepare yourself for that. And bear in mind, my family and kids are all over in London. So, you know, so Dad's talking to them and, you know. So then the doctor came, and I remember there was two of them. And once again, I couldn't see, but I could hear what I had quite a bit of drugs on board at that time to try and soften the pain, but I understood what was going on. And the doctor said, we're not going to operate. And I said, well, no, come on, let's go. I'm ready to go. You know, if this is what we have to do, we have to do it. And he said, no, you're functioning too well. We don't know how you're functioning, but you're functioning so you can talk. You know where you are. You can move. And they said, we don't understand, because he just sort of described it, when this happens, bang, you know, the back artery bursts and blood just, you know, seeps and goes.
Right.
And the swelling and all that sort of thing. And the brain's all about, it's like all wired up, it's all wires. And when it hits the wires, that's what it affects. And he said, you should be dead. Secondly, if you're not, which you aren't, you should have no feeling in the whole of your left side of your body and shouldn't be able to move. You have. And you can talk.
Yeah.
And we don't know how, but we think that it's too risky to operate. Because you're almost normal. I couldn't see, but I said, well, what are we going to do? And he said, we're going to dehydrate you and try and reduce swelling that way, and that's going to take 3 to 4 days.
Okay.
So bear in mind, I've just travelled like for 50 hours and had no sleep for two or three days and 50 hours, including the 12 hours wait and all that sort of thing. So it was a tough 3 days. That was all pretty touch and go. I mean, yeah, I don't want to go through that again.
I can imagine.
And then...
your parents probably sat by the bed the whole time. And
it
terrible
was pretty
for
tough
them.
For them as well. And my wife and kids at home, you know. And so about... I remember the morning of day four or something like that. Morning, like 3 o'clock in the morning or something. And it was getting a bit too much. And you start to think about, you know, our wife will be all right, she's okay, the kids, you know, she'll look after them. You start to think sort of things like that. And then, I want to fight this because I want to see my kids again. And wife as well. Got to include her.
Yeah, better. Very important point.
So there. I'm not saying that, but there was a real mental, no, I'm not giving up. And it was so close to actually, I can't do this anymore. And...
because, as in, so the pain, this is too much, this is awful.
It's too hard. Okay. And then, I'm going to... And I just made a mental sort of, no, come on, you know, you've got to do this. But at the same time, that's when my mental approach sort of became stronger. But at the same time, as I mentioned, the doctors always said it'd take 3 to 4 days before we know whether your body's going to be able to do this or not. And it was day 3.5. And... basically, my father came in the next morning at about 8 o'clock, and he said, there's a different person. And I felt, I'm not saying my brain's that strong or my mind and will is that strong, but that coupled with, I'm not saying it's weak either, but that coupled with the fact that what the doctors were doing to my body physically, together actually then, I improved pretty quickly.
Right.
And I was out probably about 3 days later, out of intensive care up to the ward, and then I was there for another week or so. But it was a really sort of turning point that, you know, luckily those things sort of coincided.
It's quite amazing you can remember that moment.
Yeah, I do. It was very, very clear.
Yeah.
It was really clear. I actually, the night before, I got my dad in and said, Dad, there's a few, you know... these are not... I'm speaking like this now, but these weren't easy conversations to have in terms of, A, me getting them out, you know,
Just physically.
Because my head and all this sort of thing. But also emotionally, because, you know, I lived in three different countries. My wife's Italian. There's stuff in Italy. There's stuff in Australia. There's stuff in, when I say stuff, bank accounts and shares and pensions and all this sort of thing. And I know about them, and my wife doesn't. So I had to start telling Dad, you know, write down passcodes and tell Isabella to, you know, contact this bloke about something. You know, he knows about all this, you know. So it's sort of... Oof. Preparing to move on almost, you know.
That's terrible.
So
your poor dad having to have that conversation.
Mm.
God.
And so anyway, it's all a bit morbid.
It isn't because of where we are.
No, no.
So here's an interesting thing. I don't think I've dared confront mortality in too much depth because, you know, why would you if you don't have to? So you were forced to, in such a real way, to face it.
Mm.
So I don't even know what the question is, but that's kind of interesting, isn't it?
It is.
To really, really confront it, to kind of taste it.
Yeah, and you're right, and I can remember that moment. It was 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. I remember it because I'm not saying I sat up in bed and it was like a light bulb goes off, but it was either you go that way or that way, and that way was the way I went. And I think that's a little bit in my makeup. You know, I'm competitive.
Fight, yeah.
You know, I want to, you know.
I think if I was confronted with mortality, loved ones would shoot across. And
which
then, yeah. And then, honestly, I think number two would not be all the great times. That might kind of be attached to number one. It would be all the regrets. It would be too much time at work, not enough time spent with that person, not enough time with that person, too much time worrying. I think that would hit me.
Yeah, I don't think I got to that point.
Right.
I tell you, because the most common question I get asked, did it change you? And you hear so many people who go through experiences like this, oh, yes, I'm going to live every day and be a... And I don't think it did, to my great dismay of my wife. She thought, I thought this would change you. No, I was joking. But because I realised before this happened, I knew that I'd had... a very lucky and I had a great life. So I didn't need a wake-up call to remind me that. And I knew I was lucky. I had a great career, I had a great family. As a kid, I grew up on the beach in Australia surfing. You know, things were pretty good.
Yeah.
And maybe this was a bit of a, well, let's balance it out, Michael. You know, you've had too good a life so far.
Karma, yeah.
But so I don't think it made me realise any more...
Mm-hmm.
that I was lucky. I think it reinforced it, but I don't think I've really changed the way I look at life or how I act or anything like that. But it was quite an experience, and even the guys I was with, they were, you know, I saw them recently. I was back out in Australia about 3 weeks ago, and we had dinner again. And there was no jokes. And, you know, so it affected them quite, you know, to see this happen. And, you know, but it was a really interesting experience to go through. And but I just knew that I'd been lucky in all senses of the word before that happened. We don't understand you and how you're doing what you do. Because the doctor said, you didn't just die. I remember this. He said, I was sitting there and he said, you don't understand what you've been through. I was after it all finished. You don't understand, you know. You've not dodged a bullet. You've dodged a great big cannonball.
Really?
And then he said, I can't explain it. And the one of the hardest things was when I came back to London after about 7 weeks or so, 2 weeks later or something after that, we had a few people that had been looking after my wife and family and all that sort of thing. There's probably about 20 or 30 people that came around just to thank them and say hi and that sort of thing. And one of the hardest things to deal with is because I look like this. I lost half my sight. I don't have my full sight anymore, but you just deal with it.
Mm.
And people had come in and they'd sort of look at you as if you're supposed to, you know, what's wrong with you?
Yes.
There's nothing wrong with me.
Yeah.
I look like I do now. And I think they sort of... You got the feeling that, oh, you know, well, that was a bit of an anticlimax, you know. But what's all that? The press have built it up and Michael's sort of talking it up. And
that
was really hard to deal with. You could, nobody said anything, but you could just see, oh, he's all right. Look, it wasn't, it's a storm in
Tampa. They were almost coming for the show.
What's and you almost want to, like? And I run into people at Waterloo Station, you know, because I can't see them where they are in those random events.
Right.
And they stop and they swear at you. And I want to say, hold on, I'm really sorry for running into you, but there's a story behind it.
Do you ever do that?
No. Don't get a chance because they're swearing at you and all that sort of thing. It doesn't happen too often.
Sure.
But there's... That was a really hard thing to deal with, in that people didn't really believe what you'd been through.
Hmm. Interesting. And so beyond the sight, is it as close to a full recovery as you could have ever hoped to
be?
Yeah,
it is. I still get... I've got sort of funny sort of sensations down my left with that, which I think sort of probably a bit of a residual effect. But, yeah.
Yeah.
I'll take it.
take it with both
and,
hands, yeah.
You know, the side thing's quite an interesting one because it's a peripheral vision to the left. And people sort of say, oh, but, you know, which eye is it? And it's not, it's the brain's, the brain develops. It's like you take a camera and you've got two lenses and the brain develops the picture that you take. And my left part, the part of my brain that deals with the left sort of peripheral vision doesn't develop the picture. So it's just blank. So if I put my hand there, I can't see it. I can't see it forever. If you close your left eye, you've still got peripheral vision in your right. I don't.
The brain is so endlessly complex. Like, I think in about 1,000 years, they'll laugh at what we thought we knew about the brain. Like, those poor guys, they only knew about 10% to what there was to know.
That's very true, and it's very, very complicated. Yeah. I don't pretend to know much about it. That's where the doctor was very good. He sort of brought it back to it's like a very complex electrical wiring system, and, you know, when wires get touched, they short.
Yeah.
You were very lucky. I didn't get many of them touched. Don't know how.
If there's people thinking that sounds all remarkable and you should write a book about it, you have, I should say. Blindsided. I know you were on with my colleague Jer speaking about it around the time. I guess you get a big reaction to something like that. Is there a message we should be putting out here about strokes, and if there's a bunch of mates having a beer and someone goes a bit funny, what you should do?
Because, oh, God, yes. Yeah.
Is there anything you want to say about that?
Well, yeah, we hear so many people talking about, you know, getting migraines and things like that, but they should be checked out as well, you know, because, you know, the body gives you signs about, you know, things aren't all that good or not right, not quite right, etc. Get them checked out, because migraines can be, you know, mini strokes, which often lead to a bigger one. And I had none of any of that. This was more just a really sad concurrence of things that came together. The other thing is, you know, if somebody's, you know, you often see, not often, but if any signs or anything like that of stroke or somebody that's, just don't hesitate. You know, I mean, that's what doctors and hospitals are there for, and it's better to be safe than having to deal with it. I mean, I think it's just about being aware of this, and there's a lot of literature and a lot of promotional sort of material out there from the Stroke Association over in the UK and here. So it's a huge issue, stroke, and it happens to young kids, people who are healthy, you know, all ages, and... Yeah, it's just something to be very aware of, I think. And look after yourselves.
Yeah, sure. Listen, what a pleasure to talk to you, and enjoy your time in Dublin. Jay. And thanks very much, Michael Leiner.
Thank you.
Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.